Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the latest research being done to help preserve and restore vision. And our guest knows a whole lot about that. It's great to have him back, Dr. David Gamm. He's the director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His clinical practice is pediatric ophthalmology. His research interests focus on human retinal development and disease. So we'll talk with him about some of the latest advances in age-related macular degeneration, glaucoma. We can talk about diabetic retinopathy and childhood onset disorders, and frankly, a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. David Gamm, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Great to be here. Thank you, Larry.
So what are some of the most common diseases of blindness or vision impairment?
What we deal with the most in our clinic, and also it's the focus of a lot of the research that we do at the Eye Institute, are age-related macular degeneration, glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, retinitis pigmentosa, and really any disease that affects the very front of the eye all the way to the back of the brain, which is the primary way station where all the vision that your eye collects goes back and gets processed.
Yeah. We have any number or estimate as to how many people are blind or have impaired vision?
It's over 100,000 in the state of Wisconsin.
That's a lot of people. So how are conditions that cause blindness or vision loss detected? But I guess it's obvious from the person who has the problem in some ways.
Yeah, oftentimes you'd be surprised. So clearly one of the most direct ways that we get is somebody gives us a call because they notice that something's up with their vision.
Yeah.
But that could be from a number of different reasons. That could be from a simple need to change your glasses. It could be from a cataract, you know, diseases or issues that can be easily corrected. At the Eye Institute, we're focused on things that we don't have good therapies for right now. And so what that amounts to are a lot of what we broadly consider degenerative diseases, because the cells that make up our eye and our retina and a lot of parts of our visual system don't have a natural capacity to regenerate themselves. So if they're lost during the course of disease or even normal aging sometimes, they can't replace themselves and they lead to permanent vision issues. And so we're interested in ways to slow that process down, prevent it altogether, or replace those cells once they're lost.
And you're doing some kind of cool work with stem cells, are you not? Cell
yeah.
therapies?
Yeah. So University of Wisconsin is on the forefront of stem cell biology in all areas of medicine, and that and the retina and the eye is no exception. So we were many, many years ago one of the first to show that you could take human pluripotent stem cells, which initially were embryonic stem cells, now are embryonic stem cells and induced pluripotent stem cells, both of which had their origin here on the campus through Jamie Thompson's work. We showed that we could take those cells, which have the capacity to make any cell type in the body, and direct them specifically to make retina, the photoreceptors, the retinal pigment epithelium, the very specialized cells that are required to initiate sight. And that gave us the clay that we needed to start thinking about producing retinas in a dish and using mm-hmm. that to understand how diseases progress and maybe to replace those cells once they've been lost in the course of disease.
And how far along are we with that?
We're remarkably far, much farther in the eye than we are in other tissue systems throughout the body. And there's reasons for that we can get into. It doesn't hurt that we have two eyes, which gives us one to work with.
Sure.
Yeah. And they're also very accessible structures in your body, and they're relatively safe to do work within. But we have stem cell, there are stem cell therapies that are the legitimate ones, and we could talk about that a little bit later. There's most of what you get online or you hear about or see on billboards are not legitimate stem cell-based therapies. They're there to take your money and probably not do much else. But there are legitimate stem cell-based therapies that are being developed, and they're being developed here at UW-Madison and other places as well. And patients are receiving them now, but they're not something that you can pay for. They're something that they actually pay you for to participate in those studies.
Oh, that's quite a difference from what we sometimes see.
Yeah. I often tell folks that the easiest way to discern legitimate versus illegitimate stem cell-based therapies is, do they ask you to pay for them? Because we're not really at a stage where we know enough that it would pay for you to open your pocketbook and support those studies to support the actual treatments themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'd call her online with something that may relate. Tom in Janesville. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I have Stargardt's disease, which is a retinal disease, and it started when I was 8 or 9 years old and progressed all my life, and I'm down to the point now where I use a guide dog, and I run Orcam and other really good assistive technologies, and I have participated in a genetic study, but I'm very curious about, and have been very curious about, where I can inquire about, for example, the stem cell therapies, if there's any stem cell therapies going on for Stargardt's. I'm 73, and I'm willing to take part in experimental studies like that. You know, and if I were to lose all my vision at this point of the game, you know, I've adapted to well enough that it wouldn't be that big a deal.
So a couple of things. First, I think it's always helpful to talk a little bit about, because the audience isn't going to necessarily know what Stargardt disease is. It's most similar to age-related macular degeneration in that it affects the center portion of your vision, but it affects younger individuals like you described. So it's sort of like a childhood onset macular degeneration, and it's the most common form of macular degeneration that occurs in childhood or early adolescence. And it's important for you to know that it's not going to take all of your vision away. It only affects the center portion of the vision, which is, of course, the most important. It's what you use to read or recognize faces. But you're not going to go totally blind. Your peripheral vision will stay with you as long as you don't develop a different eye disease. So Stargardt's disease is caused by a specific defect in a gene that essentially creates like a poison pill within one of the cell types in the retina. And then that gets gobbled up by another cell type. And that cell type eventually degenerates or dies because it ingests that, quote, poison pill. And so the different therapies that are being devised for that are drug-based to try to dissolve that poison pill or somehow get rid of it so you don't lose additional vision. And those are being actively pursued right now. But in a person like yourself who's later on in the disease, that's not going to help because the cells themselves are no longer around to be treated with that particular drug. So in your case, you're right. You're looking at actually replacing those cells. And stem cell biology has that potential to do so. Right now that we are, you know, my group as well as there are other groups around the world that are looking at ways to replace the two cell types that are necessary to replace to improve your vision. And those are likely to be going to patients in probably the next 3 to 5 years. And that seems like an eternity to you, I'm sure, and that's always the case. But the fact of the matter is we have to make sure that everything's safe first. And we certainly could, in the process of doing a study that isn't well controlled and well worked out, could harm some of your residual vision. We wouldn't want to do that. So the technology is growing by leaps and bounds. I think it will be available. It's not going to be a magic bullet and completely erase all vestiges of your Stargardt disease, but it'll be there. The other stuff that you might see online right now is really not vetted by the scientific and medical communities.
Tom, does that help?
It does, and I was just wondering where I can go to kind of keep track of or let people who are doing this research make them aware of me and that I'm willing to work with them?
So you said you were already in a study, and by any chance is that out of Medical College of Wisconsin?
I believe it
That's
is.
Okay.
And
it's
a genetic study, and right. My tree and the whole nine yards.
Okay, yeah, that's a natural history study that's going on there. My advice would be we have a genetics group here at the University of Wisconsin, the Department of Ophthalmology, run by Kim Stepien. So you can contact the Department of Ophthalmology here and get plugged in to our genetics group. And they are all kind of a one-stop shop, as are we, for available trials.
All right. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you just go online, right, for that?
He could. Yep, or you can call the department, or you can do it through the, I can also contact the McPherson Eye Research Institute, and we would direct you as well.
And do it that way. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking a bit about gene editing, can you talk some more about that and how that plays into your work?
Yeah. So, again, if you think about the progression of diseases, you know, very, very early on, you may not have any knowledge that you have a problem at all. Everything's working just fine, but there's something lurking around the corner. At that stage, you really want to do everything you can to preserve what you have. And then a little bit later on, when things start to get a little bit awry, and you might notice some vision changes, but the cells in your eye that are responsible for seeing are still around. They're just not working very well.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you still have the capacity to act on the disease process with either a drug or perhaps fixing the gene if it's a gene-based disorder. And then later on in the disease, when the whole cell is gone, then you have to replace the whole house. A gene or a drug isn't going to help. So gene editing is good in that middle zone where you still have some vision remaining. Maybe it's deteriorating rapidly, but you still have some there to work with. And if you can go in at that point and fix the genetic problem that's causing your vision to go down, then you might be able to slow it down or stop it altogether. That's not going to be everybody, though, because a lot of the diseases that we deal with, including macular degeneration, aren't genetic disorders. So there isn't really a gene to fix.
Yeah.
But a lot of the diseases we work with, especially those that affect children, are related to single genes that are defective.
And so macular degeneration, is that just a question of aging or it's not gene-based?
So one of the fields that we're working on at the Eye Institute very strongly is getting a sense of why is it that people lose vision.
Yeah.
It's widely considered that if we all live to be 150 or 160, we all have macular degeneration. In other words, it's just our parts wearing out, that if we live long enough, that would be the end result. Because it's such a highly metabolically active tissue, the most metabolically active tissue in your entire body. But why is it that some people, when they're 50 or 55, that part wears out, whereas other folks can live to be 110 and it doesn't? So getting a sense of what it is in some people versus others that allow them to have a more hardy retina is work that we have researchers on right now. And if we understand that, then we might be able to do a better job of trying to preserve or extend the life of your retina, both in disease as well as in normal aging.
You know, I'm wondering about lifestyle, and Chris from Adams wanted some guidance from you, Dr. Gam, about lifestyle choices that can affect vision health. Eating well, exercising, smoking cigarettes.
Absolutely. So I failed to mention, so in looking at normal retinal aging, Dr. Aki Akita, who's in the Department of Medical Genetics and a McPherson Eye Research researcher, he's specifically looking at that. And in this regard, we have Dr. Julie Maris, who's a specialist in nutrition and vision. So the Institute really, and the university really does stretch across the whole gamut of these questions. And so she's looked very strongly at the role of nutrition and carotenoids and the idea that, you know, eating your green leafy vegetables and your yellow pigmented
carrots.
Exactly. and there's a lot of truth in that. And so you want to have a healthy diet. You want to exercise. Those sort of things absolutely have a great effect on your vision and your health in general. And smoking is one of the worst things you can possibly do, specifically for age-related macular degeneration. It's been known for a long, long time that smoking greatly increases your risk of either getting macular degeneration as well as having it progress more rapidly. And people will take vitamins, and those vitamins have been shown to help. But smoking erases the benefit of that 10 times more than taking the vitamin does. So the whole idea of I'll take that vitamin and I can still smoke doesn't work. It's just like your dad who says, I'll take an extra Lipitor and have another pizza. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So stopping smoking is probably the most important thing you can do for your visual health.
Dr. David Gam, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today. Natalie Guyette, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vision and vision research with our guest today, Dr. David Gam. Been with us a number of times. Always great to have him stop by. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. Join in. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our phones are full right now, 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call. Jake in Madison will give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. So I'm 24 years old, and I have amblyopia in one of my eyes, and I didn't even know that I had it until I was about 10 years old when I started referencing my bad eye, and my parents kind of looked at each other a little crazy. And I was just curious if there's any research out there that's known to improve quality of life or improve vision in people with amblyopia, since it's something that's generally only treated as a child.
So I was just curious
if you can, you know, lead me in the right direction there.
Yeah, it's a great question. And as a pediatric ophthalmologist, so my clinical and surgical practice is with kids. So we deal an awful lot with amblyopia.
What is it?
So amblyopia is actually a visual deficit that's at the level of the brain. So if you're born with an imbalance in your vision between your two eyes, so that could either be because your eyes are not aligned correctly so that you would be predisposed to seeing double, or if the vision in one eye is degraded because you may have a difference in prescription between the two eyes. But for some reason, your brain isn't getting a good image from one eye or the other. And, you know, hundreds of years ago, there's nothing you could have done about that. And the brain has better things to do with itself than devote real estate to an eye that doesn't work very well. And so there's a period of maturation, a visual maturation, like you learn to walk and you learn to talk. Well, there's also a period of time in your life when you're young where you learn to see. And if during that time your brain doesn't get good input from an eye, it'll find something else to do. And that becomes hardwired. So there is that period where an intervention isn't instituted that – and it's like cement hardening. It's not like it's a light switch coming on and off. That it's a permanent effect, and it's an effect at the level of the brain. Now, we've learned over time that the plasticity in the brain is more than we expected it to be. So we used to say, well, if we haven't fixed you by the time you're 7 or 8 years old, there's nothing we can do. And what we would normally do, we'd put you in the glasses you need, or we'd do surgery to straighten your eyes and then patch you or do other things to make your brain pay attention to your, quote, weaker eye. But if you do that when you're in your teens or later on in your life, it really doesn't help. We have, in more recent years, seen that a small amount of improvement can be obtained in individuals if we get to them, if they've never been treated, in their early teens. There are other approaches that you'll see on the internet that will be out-of-pocket costs, and they can be thousands and thousands of dollars that will claim that you can get much better vision in the weaker eye, but they really haven't been shown or proven to be effective. So at this point, the most important thing you can do, sir, is to wear glasses that are polycarbonate to protect your better seeing eye. And then if you have kids, have them screen too, because it tends to run in families, and so your children will be more apt to have it than the average couple having children out there, and maybe we can get a hold of them sooner than you were able to.
And sooner is better if you can.
Absolutely. It's like cement hardening. So the sooner you make the diagnosis, the sooner you can institute the interventions necessary. These days we can usually get folks to near normal vision.
And I imagine now any more youngsters are kind of tested, hopefully, that...
Yes. So screening is much better than it used to be. Still, the front line are our wonderful primary care doctors. So the pediatricians and family practitioners, the folks that you go in to see your child and get the well-child checks, they're the ones doing – they're on the front lines, really, and they're picking up the vast majority, and they do a great job. On top of that, we have screening programs, photo screening programs that are now instituted oftentimes at the level of pre-K or kindergarten, which is not as early as we'd love to see them, but plenty early enough for us to oftentimes cure, if not greatly improve the vision if it's detected at that age.
And so for Jake's case here, he's – how old are you, Jake?
24, I thought.
24?
Yeah, 24. Unfortunately, I'd love to say that there was something there, but honestly, at this point, there's really not anything that's scientifically proven that would be of great benefit to the vision in the eye that you don't use very well. I will say, too, that it is common that it's not picked up in this case until a little bit later on, unless you're screened for it, unless you've got a very astute primary care physician, because as a child, it's just what you're used to. You walk around. You don't bump into walls because you have one good seeing eye, and we all can close one eye, and we're not going to walk into a wall. And you adapt to it. And I'm sure you do extremely well, even with that one eye. Am I correct?
Yeah, I do. You should see them at the DMV when I do my eye test.
Absolutely, like absolutely. And you're probably good at sports the whole nine yards. We've had there are individuals that have played professional sports, NBA, NFL, that have amblyopia in one eye, and that's because the brain is remarkably adaptable. And so even when you're faced with pretty significant problems with one eye at birth, sometimes we have to remove an eye if there's a tumor, for instance. It's amazing when I watch these kids grow up and what they can do. About the only thing they can't do is be an ophthalmologist or an airline pilot. But other than that, my money's on them. They do amazing things.
Other than that, you're good to go, Jake. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Protect that good eye, though.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. And watch your lifestyle, too.
No smoking.
Yeah, exercise, if you work eat
on,
right.
If you work on your cars, wear your protective glasses, all those things. Yes.
Keith in Waukesha, we'll go to you. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for calling, Keith.
Yes, I'm 51 years old. I was born with premature retinopathy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was when I was born, I lost my right eye, so I have a prosthetic eye in my right eye, and I've been living with premature with this for my entire life. And my question is that I have there's a small tear where there's scar tissue that's holding the retina in place, and I've had it for 51 years. Is there any type of therapy that's on the horizon that could perhaps strengthen that, that where the scar tissue is, or?
Okay. So just to clarify a little bit. So you had retinopathy of prematurity, and when you had, and how old are you, sir?
51.
51. Okay. So, again, back when you had this, very little was known about how to control oxygen levels and how to try to prevent retinopathy of prematurity. So we're much better at it now, but it still does occur. And you've lost one eye and you've got another eye. And how well does that eye serve you, your remaining eye?
I'm nearsighted. So okay. It's like 20/40.
Gotcha.
I had cataract surgery. Like 6 years ago.
So that area of scar tissue must be kind of off center, right? So it's not in the center of your vision, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to make this very easy. Don't touch it. You've got 20/40 visual acuity in your one good eye. That's allowing you to, you're driving, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's allowing you to do all of your activities of daily living. And I wouldn't be looking to mess with that eye unless you absolutely had to. Because this is a good point. I mean, whenever you're doing experimental therapies or thinking, can I remove a scar tissue or something like that, there's always the potential that there's harmful effects of those interventions as well. So from a surgical standpoint, certainly don't touch it. Now, I think what you're getting at, though, is more of a therapy where you can strengthen the area where it's at without having to have surgery. Is that right? So the answer to that is no. And again, there's kind of a very mechanical reason for that. So the retina is like a film in the back of your camera. It lines the back of your eye, and it works just like a piece of film. And just like a piece of film, if you were to cut out a piece of film, there's no way to replace that. So there's no way to kind of exercise anything to fill it in. What the brain does, though, on its own, and has done this since you were a child, is kind of fills it in themselves. Because you probably, when you look at something, you don't necessarily see a cookie cutter missing part of your visual field, right?
No.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Because your brain fills that in. It's done a great job. Again, goes back to the ability of your brain to adapt. The best friend of an ophthalmologist and the worst friend of an ophthalmologist is a brain. Sometimes it does remarkable things. Sometimes it can really put patients in a bad spot, depending on when the problem arises. But because yours happened when you were little, it's your friend. No, I don't think there's anything you need to do. I don't think even if you were able to improve it a little bit, you probably wouldn't notice much of an improvement. I think it's very fortunate that you've got that one good eye and it's escaped any really, really significant damage from the ROP.
There you go. Thank you so much, Keith, for calling. Let's go to Rod in Menominee, Michigan next. Hi, Rod.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call and my questions. I am approaching 65 in May. I've been diagnosed with macular degeneration, the wet form. My mother, who passed away on the 29th of December, also had macular degeneration and was completely blind. I'm right now undergoing treatment in Green Bay with an injection approximately once a month. I'm also on ARID2, which is sort of an eye vitamin. And my question to you, besides that, I found out about the macular degeneration after I discovered I had a hole in my eye, which they patched up, and approximately 6 months down the road is when I started having the vision, looking at horizontal lines. They were all wavy, like a cardioencephalogram, and then also vertical lines, which were sweeping. Now, I find myself very, very itchy eye and other things besides that. So the main question I guess I have, genetically, should my children, two sons, be also aware of the problems that may occur in their early life?
All right. Well, thank you for that question. There's a lot going on there. I'll address a couple. First of all, the itchiness, not related. That's totally separate. So just I can separate that out from everything else that's going on. Secondly, you had mentioned that your mother had gone completely blind from macular degeneration. And I want the audience to know that if she did go completely blind, then she had something in addition to macular degeneration. Because as I talked about earlier with the caller that had Stargardt disease, it only affects the central vision. You keep your peripheral vision. And I find that just that knowledge alone really is solace to individuals who are fear that they'll lose all their vision, like they'll go black blind. But that does not happen with AMD. With regard to the genetics of it, again, this is good. We talked about that a little bit earlier too. There are genetic components to it. So there are over 20 different genes that have been either mildly linked to or very subtly linked to the onset and progression of macular degeneration. So there certainly is a component of inheritance to macular degeneration. But just like, say, your weight, your height, and you know, diabetes, things like that, it's not like it's a single gene where I can point to it and says, aha, you've got X, and so you're going to get this. It's much more complex than that, and it does have a lot of environmental factors involved as well. That's why the vitamins help. That's why we talk about exercise and not smoking. So this really is a combination, like probably everything in our life, of genetics and environment. The fact that your mother had it and you had it does suggest that it more strongly runs in your family, and that predisposition is probably there. So letting your children know that that's the case and making sure that they don't smoke, that they are, you know, exercising, that they're having a good diet with green leafy vegetables and orange and yellow foods as well is important. The vitamins, though, which can be expensive, have not been shown to prevent the onset of disease. So taking them ahead of time has not been something that's been shown to stop that from happening. It doesn't hurt you, except maybe in your pocketbook, but those studies just haven't been done.
All right. Rob, thank you very much for calling. Let's take another call. Mary in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, after a bout with shingles, some of the retinal capillaries were occluded, and I lost about 85% vision in one eye. And I'm wondering if there's any, and I guess the retina just died in a certain area of the eye. And I'm wondering if there's anything that could be done to improve that situation. Any relief or anything?
Mm-hmm. Okay, it seems like I'm telling everybody you got to wait. but it really does play into what the Eye Institute is here for, and that is for our hopeful patients, for folks that don't have something right now that they can turn to, but something that we're looking to create in terms of a therapy for them in the foreseeable future. And this is one of them, too. This is a very complex problem, though, that you're bringing up. And so what essentially you had was a blockage of the blood flow to the eye based upon a reactivation of essentially the chickenpox virus. And that's a very insidious little critter, that chickenpox virus, and it hides in deep within your nerves and can get reactivated and can affect any part of your your eye, really, including the retina, as it did with you. And if it does lead to those blood vessels getting dysregulated or clogging up, then it can cause a good portion of your retina to become dysfunctional or to die off. And your retina really is a part of your brain. It's kind of an outpost that's specialized to detect light, but it's made up of the same cell types that there are in the brain. So just like you have a stroke in your brain, you can't go in and replace that chunk of brain. You can't right now replace that chunk of retina. But unlike the brain, it's a much more simple part of your nervous system. And so we can grow them. So one of the things that we've done in the Eye Institute is we've developed techniques to take blood or skin, convert those into cell types called induced pluripotent stem cells, and then derive that patient's own retinal cells and retinal tissues. Now, it's one thing to make the spare parts, which we're world leaders in doing in the Eye Institute. It's another thing to be able to install them and get them to hook back up to the brain. So in your case, it's pretty far down the line. I mean, where I'd say if we're going to look at kind of an analogy, you know, right now we're kind of learning, we're going from crawling to walking, and you're going to need a full-out sprint to be able to improve the vision in an eye that's had the particular insult that yours has had. But we're making great strides towards that aim. So you and a lot of the other folks that have talked here, you're the reasons why we go to work every day. You're the reasons why we study these diseases and to develop therapies that we hope in the foreseeable future, in your lifetime too. We're not talking 100 years from now. I won't be around in 100 years. So we're looking in the next 5 to 10 years to have something that we hope will push the needle. It's not going to be a grand slam home run out of the park therapy right off the bat, but like all good things, hopefully it'll improve your life, and then slowly over time we'll be able to improve it.
And Mary, thank you so much for calling. Jim in Cedarburg emailed to say that while he was listening to the People's Pharmacy program on Saturday, the research scientist that they had on was Dr. David Sinclair of Harvard, who spoke about some success with retinal cells. And wondering, Dr. Gamm, if you know research scientist David Sinclair.
I don't know that particular person personally. We actually have a number of projects with Harvard-based scientists. Most of our research is done with local folks here at the University of Wisconsin. From a stem cell and cell replacement standpoint, you know, oftentimes you don't realize just what's going on in your own backyard. Mm-hmm. But most of the folks at other institutions actually come to us to collaborate on projects in this area, because we're world leaders in this. And so we have individuals from other institutions around the world that work with us for these types of therapies. But I'm not familiar with this particular individual, no.
Sarah in Lodi, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Excuse me. Thank you for taking my question. I was diagnosed with, they're describing it as, between the layers of the retina, I have something that's like scrunched up cellophane.
Mm, yes.
And they do CAT scan, I guess, at the ophthalmologist's office to monitor it, but it's kind of stable. It's just irritating because it's cloudy just in one part of my vision. It doesn't block my vision through the cloudiness, but
it distorts your vision a little bit.
They're saying that it does. Mm-hmm. And almost like you think there's mucus on your eye and you want to wipe it away.
Gotcha.
And they have said that until you really lose 80% of your corrected vision, they don't like to do surgery because there's huge incidence of blindness with the surgery. Do you know if there's anything new coming? Or
so I can clarify this. What you're describing is what's called an epiretinal membrane, or an ERM. So in the middle of your eye, you have a jelly. It's called a vitreous. And that jelly has or we'll call it a pudding because there's a pudding skin. And that pudding skin attaches to the surface of your retina. So it's not between your layers of your retina. It's actually on the surface of your retina. And as we get older, and especially if you're nearsighted, are you nearsighted?
Yes.
Okay. It's more often in folks who are myopic or nearsighted. That jelly kind of starts to collapse on itself, and it will pull away from the retina. And sometimes it leaves a little bit of that transparent skin, pudding skin, on the surface of the retina, sort of like a cellophane. We'll also call it a cellophane retinopathy, actually. And it's transparent, but what happens is it will contract and sometimes wrinkle up. And so it's like looking through a little bit of a wrinkly piece of cellophane. And it tends to degrade vision kind of to the 20/25 to 20/40 range. And it's correct. If you go in and do a surgery and try to peel that off, it's called a membrane peel, and retina surgeons do this, there's always a risk that you could come away with poorer vision. Now, you won't go blind from it unless you pull the whole retina off. So I think that, like a lot of things, that's an over-exaggeration. But you always have to weigh the pluses and minuses, the benefits and the detriments to any procedure. And so it's possible that they could go in, remove that retinal membrane, and you'd be worse off than you were beforehand. So oftentimes people do watch that, and if it crosses a certain threshold, then the risks, the benefits outweigh the risks, and people go ahead and do it. So that's the thought process that your surgeon is going through.
All right, there we go. Thank you. And probably if you're going to have it done, you'd want to have somebody who'd done it a few times.
Yeah, like a lot of things, repetition is important. So you want to have somebody who's got a good reputation. And thankfully, here in the state of Wisconsin, we've got wonderful practitioners in eye disease and ophthalmologists. In particular here at UW-Madison, our surgeons and clinicians are just wonderful.
Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate your call. Isabella in Prairie du Chien, we're going to you next. Hi, Isabella.
Hi there. Two questions. I have one drusen in one eye. I'm 64 years old. My father had macular degeneration. He lived to be 97, but his disease didn't start until he was in his 70s, mid-70s. I'm wondering what is the chance of this developing in the other eye? I have no problems currently. First question. Second question is, what is your opinion on blue blocker glasses for heavy computer use and outdoor work?
I'll take the second one first, and that is, to me, I think that wearing sunglasses is a good thing to do. It certainly does reduce what we call asthenopia, or a sense that your eye is aching, because in different lighting environments, different muscles in your eyes, ciliary muscle, things like that can cause what's perceived as a strain. I think that a lot of the what you see on the internet and other things that purport the tremendous benefits of wearing these things are really trying to sell you those glasses. I think that the actual benefit to your retina and to your eyes is relatively minimal. But it doesn't hurt, and if you can afford these things and it makes your eyes feel better or more comfortable, then I would say go ahead and do that. It certainly doesn't hurt. Getting back to your question about macular degeneration, you used the word drusen, or we'll say druse. And those are scary words to a lot of folks, because everyone goes back and they look it up and they go, oh my goodness, that's one of the prominent things you see in macular degeneration. But you can also see drusen just as a normal aging process too. So just because you have one or two drusen or what have you doesn't mean that you're going to develop macular degeneration or lose any vision whatsoever. It could just be something that you have and that you'll have the rest of your life, and it won't blossom into anything else. It depends on how many you have, their characteristics. So there's what are called soft drusen, hard drusen. We can do a lot of complexities with regard to it. The fact that you have a family member, though, that had vision loss from macular degeneration does increase the risk that this might progress. But it's very hard to predict. And there was a multi-institutional study that was done that followed hundreds and hundreds of individuals with early macular degeneration just to see if there was any sort of pattern that would allow us to predict those who would progress and those that wouldn't. And there are a series of characteristics that you can look at that put you into different categories that your retina surgeon should be able to inform you of. But if you just have one drusen in one eye, and again, how old are you?
64.
So, you've got a long way to go before you would recognize any sort of vision loss. So I think you're in a relatively good position. I would say institute the things we talked about earlier. I'm sure you have a healthy diet. You're not smoking, things like that. Are you using the Arid vitamins?
I made my own combination based on their
Oh, you're a smart woman. Smart woman. That's a good way to save a lot of money. You got to, it's an extra meal a day. You have to, if you're going to do them separately. But yes, you can just look at what's on the bottle and then go to the generic aisle and look and take the same dosages there. But you've got to be really careful about that because some of those vitamins are fat soluble and you can overdose on those too. So just make sure that you do it under the care of your physician.
All right. Thank you, Isabella, for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. David Gamm, our guest today, who directs the McPherson Eye Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's always great to have him come by. And great to have you listening in. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at vision and research going on at the University of Wisconsin with our guest today, Dr. David Gamm, who directs the McPherson Eye Institute. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really appreciate having you with us today as we've had some great questions as we've gone through the show. And I did want to bring up a fundraiser and a way that you guys have been getting some help financially from people in the community. I can say that I've also gone online and contributed to it as well because I think it's such a worthwhile effort. It's called Cycle for Sight, isn't it?
Yeah, and thank you for doing that, by the way. Mm-hmm. So this is our ninth year for doing this, and we started it really as a public awareness. We wanted folks to know what was going on, again, in their own backyard and that they weren't forgotten, that we have literally hundreds of researchers that are devoted towards to finding new cures for and therapies for people with blinding eye disorders. And so, you know, we thought, well, if we break even on this event, but we raise awareness and we're able to connect to people in the state with what the type of research that we're doing here in Madison, that would be good. Because oftentimes just being able to relay good information to folks helps them. So even when there's not a therapy right now for you, to know that you're not forgotten and to get good information is valuable. So we started it that way. And then over the course of the years, it just grew. And we've had some wonderful sponsors and we've had folks and families now that will ride not only in Madison, but they have family members around the world that will do these cycle events. It's a sit down in sight and cycle event. And now we're routinely raising money more in excess of $50,000 a year, and that goes directly to the research here at the UW-Madison within the Institute. And a lot of that goes to a particular program that we have that's named after a wonderful young woman, Kenzie Valentine, who unfortunately passed away in 2017 from a disorder that also affected her vision. And her family has been strong backers, and we've been able to do great things with that, with the funds that we raise to support the research at UW-Madison.
Well, I know it's pretty easy to get involved because I think I didn't ride myself, but I contributed. Just went online.
Yes, so we're equal opportunity. You know, if we think it's a great thing to be able to get out in the winter and sweat a little bit, and so it's an indoor cycling event. That's how it's based. But we also have folks that will go and just walk indoors. Mm-hmm. We have, like I said, you don't even have to. You can do it from home if you wanted to. And so you can sign up your team or individuals. It's $15 a person. And then, of course, we would encourage folks if they want to go and raise additional funds. That, of course, all helps us. But again, we're not going to be dictators about this. If you're out there and helping us, we're very appreciative.
And if they go to the McPherson Eye Institute website.
Mm-hmm. That's vision.wisc.edu is the Eye Institute's general website. And then for the Cycle for Sight specifically, if you want to jump just to that, it's visionsave.wisc.edu.
And the first one again was?
Vision.wisc.edu.
Vision.wisc.edu.
Yes. Yeah. I had to think about that because it's on a I click on it. It's just an icon. I visit it very often, as you might imagine.
Bob in Franklin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hello. My mother is 90. And she's had retinitis pigmentosa, and now she's completely blind. She's been talking about getting a retina transplant or an eye transplant as So I'd like to know, is anybody working on that?
So that's actually, and I'll kind of clarify a little bit of what you're talking about here, but that's really where we shine in the Eye Institute. That's one of the areas that we're on the forefront worldwide for. And, you know, the concept of a retina transplant, really, we're not nowhere near there yet. When people talk about eye transplants, they're usually talking about corneal transplants, so replacing the clear dome at the front of the eye. The retina, as I mentioned before, is a part of the brain and it's attached to the brain. So a retina transplant is akin to a brain transplant, which seems really, really far-fetched, but is now something we're actually thinking about being able to do. But that's still quite a ways off. In retinitis pigmentosa, though, specifically, it's one layer, one deep layer within the retina that dies off. It's a layer that contains the photoreceptors, the rods and cones that are responsible for initially detecting light. And they die slowly over the course of a person's lifetime. And once they're gone, you either have to bypass them altogether with an artificial form of vision, and we do work on that as well at the Eye Institute at UW, or you want to replace the cells. And that's something that my laboratory and other laboratories are working very hard to do. And so over the course of the last 8 years or so, we've gotten to the point where we can grow in a laboratory dish the parts of the retina, the photoreceptor cells that have slowly degenerated in folks with retinitis pigmentosa like your mother. And we can do that now in a very safe manner. We can scale it up so that we can have literally trillions of these cell types that we can create. And we're gearing up, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years, to be able to test those in human patients with retinitis pigmentosa. So now, getting back to your mother, you know, if at the age of 90, she likely would not be on the first cohort of a small number of patients that we would go into because there are other comorbidities. So assuming she's very, very healthy, she would still be a candidate, assuming that all goes well, for maybe a second or a third wave.
All right. There we go, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Patricia in Baraboo, it's your turn.
Yes, thank you very much. Just a little background. I started wearing glasses at 7. I started wearing hard contact lenses at 16. I had a vitreous detachment in both eyes in 2005. And now I'm dealing with cataracts. And when I went to make the appointment, they said, oh, hard lenses. So I'm in the period of having to go back to glasses, which I started at the beginning of January. And my vision's pretty compromised between the hard lenses being off my eyes. And I understand that is so the curvature of the eye will go back to what it wants to go back to. So I'm in a strange period because I'm not seeing very well out of the glasses because probably the curvature is changing, but also the cataracts. So I wondered if you had any words of wisdom because it's pretty depressing and I'm feeling very limited.
Sure.
Where I wasn't a couple years ago. And then there's one more question, but I'll wait. And it has to do with the same thing, but to not confuse things, I can let you.
I greatly appreciate that. Thank you. So I can at least, probably the nicest thing I can say to you is this too shall end. So it'll take a little bit of time. They are doing the appropriate thing. Do you have a lot of astigmatism as well?
Well, I had less. It seemed like I had more before, so I don't know what's going on now.
Okay. So, and you're very nearsighted myopia.
Very nearsighted.
You're kind of like, are you in the -7 to -8 range?
I think I'm even higher than that. Like
even
higher. -9, -11.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even higher than that. And that does increase your risk of retinal detachments, which you said you already had. So all those things, you know, when you have cataract surgery as well, that also increases your risk of perhaps having retinal detachment. So you want to make sure your retina surgeons, and sounds like she or he is very on top of all these things. So I think you've got a wonderful person that you're working with. But those are all considerations that you want to have prior to undergoing the surgery. But they're exactly right that when you're in contact lenses, that does change the shape of your eye. And ultimately, you'd like to either reduce your need for glasses or get rid of them altogether after your surgery, right?
Right.
So if your eye is falsely shaped due to the contact lens, or artificially shaped, I should say, due to the contact lens, and they take it off and immediately do your cataract surgery because they have to measure the length of your eye and various features of your eye to make sure they put in the correct replacement lens after they remove your cataract. So you want that to be based on where your eye's actual natural shape that it will be at once you're not using your contact anymore. So you do have to have this period of time, and the longer you've been in them, the longer you kind of have to wait till they stabilize. And usually they'll bring you in, remeasure you, then make you go home and come back again and see if the measurement's changed. And as long as it's continuing to change, you still kind of have to do that watch and wait. But in the end, you'll be more happy with the results by having gone through all that.
Why would you have hard contacts to begin with?
Well, when did you start them? A long time ago?
Age 16. 1967.
1967, yeah. Okay. Because they didn't have, these days, that's why I asked if she had astigmatism, because these days we mostly use rigid gas permeables if you're trying to also address a great deal of astigmatism. If you were to have started today and you were in that minus 9 to minus 11 range, wherever you're at, with a manageable amount of astigmatism, which means that your eyes shaped, in addition to being nearsighted, shaped a little bit like a football instead of a basketball. The curvature is different in one direction than another. They would probably have done soft contact lenses. But back then, people who were going into contact lenses were going into rigid gas permeable. And if you were used to them, then you stayed in them. And there's a lot of benefits to them as well. They're just harder to get used to.
Just harder to get used to. Someone was wondering, and I actually wonder myself, why is it that it's more difficult for night driving for as you age, it seems like?
Yeah. Okay. That has to do with, a number of things. But I'll bring up one feature, and that's your pupil size. So I'm 51, and so I'm starting to notice now that if I'm in a dimly lit environment and I'm trying to read a menu, that thankfully I'm tall and I've got these orangutan-like arms, so I can stick them far away from it and I can see, right? So the larger, your eye has to focus light. And so light comes into the eye, and if it's coming through the very center of the eye, it just passes straight through and it's perfectly focused all the way along the length of the passage of the light into the eye. The further away it is from the center of the eye, the more the features of the eye have to bend that light so that you see clearly. You want me to take it on the other side? The bigger your pupil, the bigger the pupil, the more light that has to be bent by your eye as opposed to a smaller pupil. So when you're driving and it's dim and the light isn't very good, then you have a much more defocused image than when your pupil's small and good lighting.
On that note, we are out of time. A big thanks to Dr. David Gamm. Don't forget about Cycle for Sight, and for more information, go to the McPherson Eye Institute website. I'm Larry Mueller.